From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Saturday Night Live's Tina Fey, the first female head writer for the show and the co-anchor of Weekend Update. Fey wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. Also, we listened back to an interview with Hubert Selby Jr. He died Monday at the age of 75. Selby wrote the novel Last Exit to Brooklyn, a book about the gangs, prostitutes, and transvestites on Brooklyn's waterfront in the 1950s. It's now considered an urban classic. When it was first published in 1964, it was shocking and controversial. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. U.S. warplanes were reported pounding parts of Fallujah today with laser-guided bombs as the U.S. seeks to end an insurgency in the Iraqi city. The military decided to delay planned patrols by U.S. Marines and Iraqi security forces. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan told reporters that American military action in Fallujah and Najaf is fueling resistance to the U.S. occupation. Yesterday, Annan's envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, told the Security Council that members of an Iraqi caretaker government should be identified by the end of May. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Lakhdar Brahimi told the council that the recent increase in fighting between U.S. forces and resistance groups undermines efforts to achieve a political transition in Iraq. Kofi Annan agreed, and he urged the United States to find a peaceful solution in Fallujah and Najaf.
Violent military action by occupying power against the inhabitants of an occupied country will only make matters worse.
Annan says the community in Fallujah has appealed for U.N. intervention, but the Secretary General says the U.N. can't help until the security situation improves. Annan expressed special concern about the situation in Najaf, a holy city for Iraq's Shiite majority. Annan said the consequences of any military assault on Najaf would be unimaginable. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
An attorney for a U.S.-born terrorism suspect told the Supreme Court today that President Bush has overstepped his authority in holding the man indefinitely without access to lawyers and the courts. The High Court heard arguments in two cases related to the government's power to hold terror suspects as enemy combatants. A government attorney said Congress gave the president broad power to pursue terrorists and head off future threats at home or abroad. John Kerry has completed a three-day swing through the industrial heartland. He assailed Bush administration economic policies as unresponsive at a time when jobs have disappeared. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Kerry has traveled by bus through four states. West Virginia and Ohio were carried by George Bush in 2000, and Pennsylvania and Michigan, which went to Al Gore. Kerry hopes that discontent over the combined loss of hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs in these states will lead voters here to support him in November. He spoke to a crowd at a community college in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And we deserve a president of the United States who doesn't just sound that one trumpet note of tax cuts for the wealthy, but who talks to Americans about how we're going to restore the manufacturing base of our nation and put America back to work. That is what we need to do in this country.
The White House, meanwhile, says President Bush will take his own bus trip next week. He'll go through Michigan and Ohio. Don Gagne, NPR News, Ann Arbor.
The Dow Industrials closed down 135 points at 10,342. The NASDAQ was down 43 at 1989. This is NPR News. The House voted today to permanently eliminate the so-called marriage penalty that forces some married couples to pay more income tax than they would if they weren't married. The bill passed overwhelmingly. If Congress doesn't act, the marriage penalty will return next year. The Bush administration has been pushing Congress to make its tax cuts permanent. The House defeated a Democratic proposal that would have offset the cost of eliminating the marriage penalty by imposing a surtax on wealthy couples. Eight African Americans have filed a federal lawsuit against the Waffle House restaurant chain. They claim racial discrimination. It's the latest in a string of such lawsuits against Waffle House. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Charles Edwards reports.
The claims against the Georgia-based company vary. One plaintiff says he had to pay before instead of after his meal, unlike white customers. Another claims he placed a carry-out order at one Waffle House, only to be told he had to pick it up at another location. Two other black plaintiffs say a cook shouted racial slurs at them while holding a knife. Company officials say they take complaints seriously and have a history of firing employees found guilty of discrimination. Waffle House also has a history of facing similar cases. Late last year, discrimination lawsuits were filed against the privately held company in Georgia and four other states. For NPR News, I'm Charles Edwards in Atlanta.
Authorities in New Jersey say a former nurse who claims to have killed as many as 40 patients will plead guilty tomorrow to 14 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder. The Somerset County prosecutor said that Charles Cullen will enter his guilty pleas tomorrow morning. Cullen was arrested last December. He'd worked at 10 hospitals and nursing homes. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tina Fey is best known as the co-anchor of Weekend Update, Saturday Night Live's weekly satire of the news. She's also Saturday Night Live's first female head writer. Now she's joined the ranks of SNL performers who have written movies. She wrote and co-stars in Mean Girls, which opens this weekend. The story is about the new girl, Katie, in an affluent suburban high school who doesn't understand the cliques or the culture of the school. She's adopted by two of the school outcasts, and with their guidance, she infiltrates the most fashionable clique in order to sabotage them. But instead, she starts becoming like them. When she falls for the boy who sits in front of her in math class, she gets his attention by pretending she doesn't understand the assignments, even though she's a great math student. Tina Fey plays the calculus teacher, Ms. Norberry, who sees how smart Katie really is and wants her to join the club known as the Mathletes. In this scene, Katie is talking with her two outcast friends at the shopping mall where one of them works. As they talk, they're surprised to see their math teacher, Ms. Norberry.
There are two kinds of evil people. People who do evil stuff and people who see evil stuff being done and don't try to stop it.
Does that mean I'm morally obligated to burn that lady's outfit? Oh my God, that's Ms. Norberry.
Oh, I love seeing teachers outside of school. It's like seeing a dog walk on its hind legs.
Oh, hey guys, what's up? I didn't know you worked here.
Yeah, moderately priced soaps are my calling.
You shopping?
No, I'm just here with my boyfriend. Joking. Sometimes older people make jokes.
My nana takes her wig off when she's drunk.
Your nana and I have that in common. No, actually, I'm just here because I bartend a couple nights a week down at PJ Calamity's. Katie, I hope you do join Mathletes, you know, because we start in a couple weeks, and I would love to have a girl on the team, just, you know, so the team could meet a girl.
I think I'm going to do it.
Great.
You can't join Mathletes. It's social suicide.
Thanks, Damien.
Tina Fey, welcome to Fresh Air. A lot of high school movies are from a boy's point of view, and a lot of time is spent leering at girls' breasts and making a lot of jokes about body functions. Why did you want to do a high school movie, and why did you want to do like a high school movie from girls' point of view?
Hi, first of all. Yeah. And well, I had been looking for a topic to write a movie about for a couple of years. I've been wanting to try to write a screenplay to see if I could do it. And when I came across this book, Queen Bees and Wannabes by Rosalind Wiseman, that was the first subject matter that seemed juicy enough to me, both on a comedy level and also just felt like it had a little substance to it. And that was the first subject matter that had appealed to me. And so that sort of led me to a high school genre movie. I didn't really set out looking for a high school movie to write, but it sort of worked the other way around.
Now, the book that you mentioned, Queen Bees and Wannabes, is mm-hmm. a nonfiction book, which I confess I have not read. So, well, what's the relationship of that book to your fiction film?
Well, it's interesting because I did make sort of a rookie mistake in wanting to adapt this non-narrative, non-fiction book that it didn't really dawn on me until I set out to work that it was going to be kind of hard. The book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, is a guide for parents and their daughters basically to help them through the treacherous middle school and high school years when girls can be very vicious to each other and what they call relational aggression among girls. And when I read the book, I did find it to be kind of funny, though, because there are a lot of interviews with real girls and anecdotes of things that they've done to each other or that have been done to them. And I thought there was this kind of ingenious behavior in the way girls very creatively destroy each other. And also it was a behavior that I had remembered as I remembered it. It was true to me, those behaviors.
So the main character in the movie is going to school. She's 16, but she's going to school for the first time because she was homeschooled previous to that in Africa by her anthropologist parents who were doing field work. Is that a premise that you made up for the movie?
I had, yes. Well, I had always wanted, I had wanted the character of Katie to be a social blank slate. And so from the beginning, I had wanted her to be homeschooled because I guess in response to the earlier question of, you know, how does the book relate to the movie, I tried to take the sort of character types that are outlined in the book and the behaviors, as many of the specific behaviors as I could, and then put them in story form. So I wanted this main character to be socially a blank slate coming into American high school. And so originally she was homeschooled, and then I think it actually came from a studio note that I think was for her to be homeschooled abroad as well. And I think that came out of a little bit of sort of prejudice against American homeschooled kids that people think they're too weird. That they thought that as a main character would be off-putting and weird.
Right, so that there had to be a kind of practical reason why she was homeschooled,
right,
as opposed to an ideology.
Right.
So she's given lessons when she comes to school about the different cliques of kids and, you know, in the nerds and the popular kids and so on. And each group has its own name. What were the groups in your school? You went to high school in suburban Philadelphia.
Yeah, I went to Upper Darby High School in Upper Darby. And we had, I'm trying to think, we didn't have so many names. I mean, jocks were always jocks. The one group that we had a name for that I think is extinct now is Hammers, were kids who were really into heavy metal and presumably drugs, were called Hammers. And I think that group is gone. I don't know what they are now. I don't think there's big heavy metal population in American high schools anymore. and we had Skate Rats at the time, too, which were skateboard punk music enthusiasts, and, you know, band geeks, and we didn't have a cool fancy name for the popular kids.
Did you feel like you fit into any one group or another?
I was definitely an academic in high school, and I was in choir and stuff like that. So I existed in the more brainiac AP class subset that we, within our own little world, we had our own relationships and dramas and scandals, but if you could sort of pull back, we were not very important in the grand scheme of things.
Now, in your movie Mean Girls, there's some scenes in health class where, I love it, where the teacher says things like, you know, here's my advice. Don't have sex because you will get pregnant and die. Here's some condoms.
Right. That was my attempt to get at sort of, because the one thing I think with high school kids in the last 15 years is it seems to me that the policy is always changing, that depending on who the president is, you know, it's abstinence one week and then it's safe sex. Here's how to put a condom on a banana the next week. And I feel like kids get a lot of mixed messages in that area.
Which kind did you get? Which message?
I got mixed messages. I had a really sort of ill-informed health teacher that guy is based on that I remember once devoted an entire class to teaching us how to spot and avoid gay people.
Oh, really?
And I remember thinking, this is not appropriate. I remember going to the dean afterwards because by that time I already had a bunch of gay friends. And I was like, I don't think this guy should be teaching this. It was like, gay people will find out what kind of music you like. Gay people will invite you to their home. I think he was really blending gay people and child molesters like freely.
What did your principal tell you in response?
I think I went to a guidance counselor who was like a family friend, and I don't remember. I don't think I got a satisfying response.
Now, in Mean Girls, you play the calculus teacher. And you know, you're divorced. You're kind of bitter about how things have gone. At the same time, you're a really good teacher, and you really want the best for your students. And you give some very good advice, like you've got to stop calling each other sluts and whores. It just makes it all right for the guys to call you that. Did you have a teacher like that, or do you just wish that you did?
Well, I had a lot of great teachers at Upper Darby, actually, and the namesake for that teacher, Ms. Norbury, was my German teacher at Upper Darby, and she was just she was young, and I thought she was very funny and had a very sort of bitter sense of humor. None of the other elements of the story are about her. She wasn't, you know, married or divorcing or anything. But I kind of had her in mind when I was writing. But then I didn't know. The you know, helping girls deal with each other part of that character is actually also comes from Rosalind Wiseman, the author, because that's what she does. She goes to schools and does these workshops with girls. And a lot of the things that my character does in the movie are just directly stealing what Rosalind does.
Uh-huh. No, Mean Girls is PG-13. Did you have to work hard to keep it that way?
We really did. And the thing I found very interesting, and I'm probably foolish to talk about it because I'll probably have trouble with the MPAA for the rest of my life now, but we had to give up a few jokes at the very end because the MPAA was threatening to give us an R, which I found to be unbelievable. I think it partly is a sign of the times and that everyone's a little nervous and clamping down on everything. And partly because the movie was about girls. We had a reference when Katie is her first day of school. A guy comes up to her in the cafeteria and says, "We're taking a survey of new students. Is your cherry popped? Would you like us to assign someone to pop your cherry?" And the MPAA was, "Absolutely not, absolutely not." And I thought, I was already a euphemism, so I thought I was going to be in the clear. And it was weird, too, because either of those things we could have said on television. But the MPAA is a little bit tougher. And we really had to lay down on the train tracks to get the phrase wide-set vagina for the movie, which out of context doesn't sound like something you'd really want to fight for. But in context, I needed it.
So why was it so important to you to have the film be PG-13 and not R?
Well, I wanted kids that age to be able to see it. I mean, part of it is, I think the studio would be, sort of business-wise, it would be terrible news if younger people weren't able to see it. And also, I think because the movie, at its core, does have kind of a positive thing for girls in it. And so I wanted younger girls to be able to see the movie.
What were some of the films you loved when you were in high school?
When I was in high school, I mean, they were already out by that time, but all the, you know, early Bill Murray movies of Stripes and Caddyshack and
Meatballs?
Meatballs, yeah. It's funny because I talk to Lorne Michaels about that sometimes, and, you know, for those guys working with Bill Murray at that time, I think Meatballs was probably a movie that they teased him about and were like, "Oh, I can't believe you're making that movie." And for me, being a kid at that age, it's like this huge seminal movie that they all were making fun of. And what else? I mean, obviously, the John Hughes movies were huge when I was that age, too, in Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. And that's why I think, for me, there was no shame in the genre. It didn't occur to me that I should be embarrassed to be writing a high school movie. But I've had people ask me since, like, "Oh, that's weird that you want to write a teen movie." But when we were growing up, they were good quality movies.
My guest is Tina Fey, co-head writer for Saturday Night Live and co-anchor of its Weekend Update. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tina Fey. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. Fey is the co-head writer of Saturday Night Live and co-anchor with Jimmy Fallon of the show's mock news report, Weekend Update. Let's hear an edition of Weekend Update from earlier this season.
On Sunday, Al Gore called for the repeal of the U.S. Patriot Act and accused President Bush's administration of undermining civil liberties and exploiting public fears about terrorism. And then, as always, the cashier nodded and gave him his Big Mac.
In a Veterans Day speech this Tuesday, President Bush vowed, "We will finish the mission we have begun, period." Afterwards, he was advised that in the future, he doesn't have to read the punctuation marks.
This January, Kevin Costner will be honored by the Palm Springs International Film Festival for his contribution to film. This gives Costner just 2 months to make a contribution to film. owners of our very own building, Rockefeller Center, have announced plans to reopen the building's 70th floor observation deck, which has been closed to the public for 17 years. Well, I guess that means that Tom Brokaw and I will have to find a new place to secretly make love. In an interview with W Magazine, Joan Rivers compared plastic surgery to car maintenance, saying you have to do it every 2 years. But even for a car, she looks awful.
Let's talk a little bit about Weekend Update, which you co-anchor with Jimmy Fallon. You started off, I think, writing on Saturday Night Live, became co-head writer. How did you end up with the Weekend Update slot, which is just a really great slot to have?
It is the fabled catbird seat. Well, I was in my fourth year, I think, as a writer, and maybe my second year as head writer. And I had been a performer at the Second City in Chicago before I came to write for the show. And so I had missed performing a little bit. And Rachel Dratch and I started doing a two-woman sketch show a couple years before that. We did it in Chicago one summer, and then the following summer we did it at the Upright Citizens Brigade here in New York. And Lorne, God bless him, came to see the show. And then once he saw me performing, then he's like, oh, well, you know, maybe you should test with Jimmy to do Weekend Update. And it was his idea from the beginning to have Jimmy and I do it as a pair. And I think we were both like, really? Okay. I don't know if this seems like a good idea. But then we tested a few times, and it ended up working out pretty well, I think.
Well, do you know what it is that made him suspect the two of you would work well together?
I think he knows the value of a star, because he's a good producer, and he knows that Jimmy is a star and, like, full of charm, and that people like him immediately. And so I think he felt like Jimmy being so likable would make people think that it was okay to like me, and I wouldn't seem so
did
strident.
Did he think you needed an assist?
Well, because that way, you know, I wouldn't seem sort of strident or awful if I had Jimmy with me, and then conversely that Jimmy would seem somehow more news reputable if I was with him somehow.
Yeah. So how does it work? Do you each write your own material?
Actually, we have three and a half writers, because we have one guy that splits his time, that write jokes all week for us, because in the beginning of the week I'm still writing sketches for the show, and so is Jimmy. We're working on the sketch portion of the show, and then these three great writers, Charlie, Doug, Frank, and our half writer David, are writing all week, and then we kind of come in on Thursday nights after the sketches are sort of up and running for the week, and read a bunch of jokes with our producer Mike Schur, and then, you know, try to add in jokes of our own. So by Thursday night I start writing jokes, but for the most part I'm either kind of just sort of readjusting jokes that are already there or adding one or two jokes. Jimmy adds a lot of the bits, the things that sort of things that I like a lot, the sort of quirky, interstitial, odd things that we do in the segment, a lot of times come from Jimmy.
So it seems funny that you'd be writing the sketches, which you're not in, and then the thing that you are in, which is Weekend Update, other people are writing. Do you ever feel like, gosh, I should be writing the thing I'm in?
Well, it's a real luxury to have other people writing it for you. And one thing I found trying to write this movie was that I found it really hard to write a part for myself. I had always intended to write a little part for myself, and I did not enjoy doing it. I would much preferred writing everyone else's part, and found it easier to come up with jokes for everyone else. So this setup might actually be good, that I can spend the week writing jokes for other people, and then those guys are writing jokes for us.
What was hard about writing for yourself?
I don't know. I think felt maybe I was too aware of my own limitations as an actor. I wasn't that excited about writing for that actor, whereas with Tim or Amy, I was more into it. Maybe it just felt selfish in some way or something, but it was really difficult.
Now, when you're doing Weekend Update, you're always wearing the same thing. You have this kind of dark suit and a white top that you wear underneath it, and of course your glasses. Mm-hmm. Do you ever dress that way outside of Weekend Update?
Do I wear suits? I don't wear a lot of suits now. No, I dress like a comedy writer sadly.
I imagine that blazer sitting in your dressing room, and then you put it on for 5 weeks every Saturday and then put it back in the dressing room.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah. It's very nice. It's a very nice blazer.
And what about your glasses? Was that ever considered like a prop for Weekend Update, or is it something that you wear a lot off of?
Well, I do need them. They are practical. I need them to read my cue cards because I can't see far away. Mm-hmm. And we tested the first time I tested without them, and then I tested the second time. I thought, well, I'll wear them because I never had worn contacts, and I bought contacts for the first screen test that Jimmy and I did, and I was sort of nervously trying. It took me like 25 minutes to get them in my eyes because I'm not used to it. And then I said, well, maybe the second test I'll just wear my glasses, and I felt a lot more comfortable with them. I felt like I had a little mask.
Of all the Weekend Updates that you've done, which are some of the jokes that have gotten the biggest reaction or that proved to be the most controversial?
That's a good question. It's funny because as soon as
it's over, you forget, right?
They've all blended in my mind. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, one of the first ones that comes to mind is we did a joke, and I would say it was probably October of 2001. It was some John Ashcroft joke of Ashcroft saying we all needed to be alert, and our response was something like, you know, I think I speak for a lot of people when I say, bitch, I can't be any more alert than I already am, and the whole little roundabout that about taking my passport into the shower with me. And I think that was a time that was very stressful to be working out of 30 Rock. Was Anthrax times over at 30 Rock. And what else? Jimmy and I did a little run together, too, about Freedom Fries that I enjoyed, which was something along the lines of, like, you know, America, maybe instead of worrying about calling them Freedom Fries, how about we just cool it with the fries altogether? We're the fattest country in the world. How about we just not eat so many fries to begin with? And just going on to harangue Americans for their ignorance.
Tina Fey is the co-head writer for Saturday Night Live and co-anchor of its Weekend Update. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writing for Saturday Night Live. We continue our interview with Tina Fey, the show's co-head writer and co-anchor of Weekend Update. Also, we listened back to an interview with Hubert Selby Jr. He died Monday at the age of 75. He's best known for his 1964 novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tina Fey, the co-head writer for Saturday Night Live and co-anchor of its weekly news satire Weekend Update. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie, Mean Girls, which opens Friday. As co-head writer, you've had to usher the show through at least two really major crises. One was September 11th, mm-hmm. and the other, the actual war in Iraq. You know, mm-hmm. the official war with the bombing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about one of those and what it was like to figure out where's the humor and what's...
Yeah.
Is anything going too far and being not only funny but disrespectful?
Right. Well, after the 11th, I think we felt what I feel almost everyone must have felt like going back to their day job at that time, which is, this is insane. Why are we at our day jobs? How are we supposed to function? Why are we bothering to function in this way? But I think everyone must have felt that way. And then, once again, Lauren's advice to us that was just that we would use our own taste as a guide in terms of what was appropriate with humor after that. And the first couple shows that we did were very clean. They didn't really even go near it so much. And then I think what changed after a show or two was we kind of got in touch with being angry and afraid. I think there wasn't a lot of comedy to be had in the sadness of what had happened. But once it became anger and letting off steam about the fear of what it was like to be living here at that time, that's when we started to have success again. I know our producer Steve Higgins wrote a very early John Ashcroft sketch that was one of my favorites. It was, I think, Steve Higgins and Mike Schur wrote it, and it was John Ashcroft giving a press conference saying, you know, everyone, everything's fine. Go about your business. Do the things you would normally do. And also, there's going to be a major terrorist attack in the next 2 days. Okay, any questions? And I just kept saying, just do the things that you do. Go to the movies. Go to the gas mask store. Whatever it is you're going to do. Build a bunker. Go to dinner. Go shopping. And I think that really was sort of a release for people at that time. It just felt like it was so insane that you felt like you were going to burst.
Was it a strain for you to try to be funny when you were living in New York and working in New York and, you know, the anthrax scare was in your building?
It was in our building.
Yeah. So was it hard to be funny?
It was a little hard to be funny about the news because I would have to come in and go on Friday, go through all the week's news. And it was horrible, horrible news, as it often continues to be. And yeah, I would be trying to write jokes in the middle of having a panic attack, basically. But what are you gonna do?
Did the staff of Saturday Night Live get together and hold hands and
frequently? The funniest thing that happens, yeah. I did one time. I did have I'm not the only person who in that first year or so would occasionally just start crying and freaking out. And I had one of those panic attacks in front of Jon Stewart, who was hosting our show at the time. And I was just behind closed doors in our one producer's office. And I was just like, I can't take it anymore. And I had Jon Stewart kind of talk me down and tell me that, you know, he was rattling off statistics about how it was more dangerous to ride in a car than to live in New York and stuff. So
Were you embarrassed?
I was embarrassed for a minute, and then I just couldn't really hold it in anymore. I had Ann Beats, who was one of the original writers for the show. Her only advice to me that she gave me one time was just don't ever cry in front of anyone. Just, you know, don't cry in front of the men because you'll lose your equal footing. And I was like, oh, Ann, it's too late. I've cried so many times in this office. It's way too late.
What are the things that get you so much that the tears come?
Well, first, the fact that I'm very often overtired, like just like a child, that I haven't slept in 3 days. And that for me, if I get angry about something, that's sort of how it comes out, that I'm not really a yeller, that the few times that I've ever just been worked up or angry about something, that's sort of how it presents itself.
Right. I know. Isn't that hard sometimes? Like if you're not the person who kind of vents and can really express your anger, you end up sometimes mm-hmm. crying instead.
Yeah. Yeah. Which when you work with all men, actually, it jolts them. It scares them a lot more than if you start yelling because they know how to handle that. But they get very upset if you cry.
Now, how did you become the head writer? Did you first get on Saturday Night Live as a writer?
Yeah, I was writing. My friend Adam McKay actually was already a head writer at the show, and I knew him from Chicago, and I had contacted him about how to seek a writing position at the show and send him a submission packet and met with him and met with Lorne and ended up getting hired. And then about 3 years in, Adam sort of wanted to retire from the position. And now he's gone. He's directing movies now and stuff. He's directing Anchorman with Will Ferrell coming
out. Oh, yeah.
Which looks like it's going to be really, really funny. And so, you know, I think I was going into my third year, I want to say, on the show. And so Lorne had said, you know, had asked me to do it, basically. And I think I have to say that a much bigger deal is made than is necessary over the fact that I'm the first woman to do it, because there really haven't been that many head writers in the duration of the show, because the first few years there was none other than Lorne. And then everyone else who's done it has done it for 4 or 5 years at a time. So it's really not that long a list of people. And I feel guilty sometimes that I let people make a big deal out of it, because it's not that big a deal.
My guest is Tina Fey, co-head writer for Saturday Night Live and co-anchor of its Weekend Update. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tina Fey. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. She's co-anchor of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update and is also the show's co-head writer. Could you describe what the job description is? Like, what do you do as head writer?
Well, as head writer, for the beginning of the week, you're a writer like everybody else, and you write your two sketches. On Monday night and Tuesday night, we write sketches, and you sort of write two of your own, and then you maybe collaborate and help other people with theirs and stuff. And then Wednesday night, the difference starts at, we have a big read-through on Wednesday, and we read about 40 sketches. And then Wednesday night, we go into a production meeting with Lorne and the host and the other producers, and Dennis McNicholas, who's the other head writer, and myself get to go in there. And the first big difference is that you get to have a say in what sketches you think should go in the show, which is the one thing that the regular writers don't get to have a say in. And then once the show is picked, we pick about 10 or 12 sketches, which is usually about 20 minutes more material than we'll need. Then Dennis and I sort of split the sketches into two halves, and we break into two groups the following day on Thursday, and he takes half the sketches and I take half of them. And it's basically then it's running this round table of going page by page, joke by joke through each sketch and suggesting cuts and suggesting, you know, better jokes here and there, or just different, you know, sometimes it's really minimal. It's just going through something that already works and kind of punching it up with everybody. And sometimes it's doing more of a page one rewrite where Lorne likes the idea and the casting, but kind of wants you to start over with stuff. And that's always a lot more work. And going through that on Thursday, and then on Friday, just sort of trying to follow up, and just mostly to be helpful to people, to the writers as they get their sketches on. I think that's the thing I've learned after doing it for a few years, that rather than trying to control people, that if you can actually just be there as a resource to help them, that it all works out for the better. Because you can't really supervise comedy writers. And the writers at our show are given so much autonomy that there's nothing really, if they really have a joke they really, really, really want to try and nobody likes it but them, they're probably going to get the chance to try it in front of the dress rehearsal audience.
And then if it doesn't go over, it's cut?
And then if it doesn't go over, it's cut, either the joke or maybe the whole sketch.
When's the dress rehearsal?
Dress rehearsals are Saturdays at 8. So we load in one audience and do a full dress rehearsal from 8 to about 10, and then go into another meeting and cut the show down to time, Lorne and the producers. And
wow, that sounds like you'd be really frazzled making those kinds of decisions at such the last minute.
Yeah, it's really exciting, actually. And it does. Sometimes we'll be in, we have a meeting then between dress and air where with the sketches that remain, Lorne goes through with everyone and gives his notes from the dress rehearsal on the sketches that are remaining. And a lot of times it ends at 11. And so you sort of have a half an hour to run around and execute the changes that he wanted you to make and make sure your cue cards are right. If you're a writer, you're responsible to check everything, basically. If you're a writer of a sketch, you're basically the producer of that sketch. So if something goes wrong, you're in trouble.
So what are you doing behind the scenes while the show is on?
It used to be during the while the actual show was on.
Yeah, while the actual show was on.
While the actual show was on, you're sort of done in a way, especially once if you had a sketch and once your sketch airs. But before that, you'll be running around to the cast, making sure they know of any changes in the script, including telling the host if there are changes, if there were changes to costumes or props. You're kind of checking up on those right before air, and then. Once you've done that, then you can just sit back and watch the show. The bulk of the work kind of gets done simultaneous with the dress rehearsal, because during the dress rehearsal, you go, if you're a writer and your sketch is in, you go and sit and watch what we call under the bleachers, which is under the audience. There's a monitor where Lauren watches the show, and the producers and Dennis, the other head writer, they all sit there, and you come in and you watch your sketch next to Lauren, and he gives you notes as it's going on, and it can be really scary. Especially for your first year or two, you're just really intimidated under there. And if the show, if it's a bumpy dress rehearsal, it can be really extra scary to be under there. And then whatever notes you get at that point, you go around and try to execute them. And a lot of times it's rewrite the whole ending, or it's cut three pages out of it. And, can the set be changed? And so there's a lot of running around to do. And you kind of, even if you have a sketch that goes terribly and you're pretty sure it's going to get cut, you have to pursue those changes and keep working on it until you get the official word as to whether or not it's cut.
Now, since final decisions are made moments before the show starts, between the dress rehearsal mm-hmm. and the actual broadcast, who gets to deliver the bad news to the people whose sketches are being cut?
Well, the way it happens between dress and air is there's a big bulletin board with all these cards of every sketch on it. And part of it that is used to move them around and put them in the right order, which is another sort of amazing process of how, we have a certain order. We'd like the sketches to go in content-wise, but then you also have to factor in can these quick changes be made, and can a camera break from one end of the studio to the other in time? And somehow it all gets worked out every week, which I think is amazing. But then what happens is the sketches that get cut, the cards just get moved off to the far left side of the board. So once the rest of everyone else gets called into the meeting, the rest of the cast and the rest of the writers, you come in and you look at the board. And that's how you find out whether you're done or not, which I think is traumatic enough for the writers, but has to be really traumatic for the cast because, that's how they find out how much they're going to be on TV or not that week.
If at all.
Yeah.
Women performers on the show have always complained that they didn't get enough parts and that many of the parts that they did get were minor characters or cliched characters. When you became head writer of Saturday Night Live, did you consciously try to change that and make sure that there were more sketches for women that were, interesting characters, centerpiece characters, and funny?
Well, it's interesting because a part of me thinks I don't know how many women really actually said that, because I know that all the women I work with now, we all kind of sort of bristle at that inevitable topic as it comes up, because I think the thing that's really fair about the show is that if you're generating your material, which the performers, they kind of have to generate their own characters and stuff. If they're generating good characters, they're going to get on. But I will say the more women you have, the more diverse the show ends up being. The more women writers, we have a female director. And I think the reason is not that anyone has ever purposely, I don't think anyone's ever purposely not put the women on the show, but I think if the audience in that room, if the writers and the cast, if it's really homogenous, if it's a lot more guys than women, then their taste is just they're going to prefer the things that they prefer. And so maybe that is a reason why when the show isn't as diverse, the content of the show ends up being less diverse. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then, sort of the other thing that I hear all the time is people, it's one of those things that gets said and then gets repeated, that the show is a boys club. And the thing that I find kind of interesting is actually, if you look at our show, women have always been stars on the show from the beginning. Gilda Radner, huge star of the show, and Jan Hooks and Nora Dunn, and Molly Shannon and Sherry O'Terry, and the women Maya and Amy and Rachel, they really dominate the show now. And it seems to me that it's actually when the people leave the show and then go to try to be movie stars or TV stars, that's when it's actually, I think the rest of the industry is a little bit harder for women than our show.
Do you have network censors anymore, or a standards and practices department?
Oh, yeah.
That and so every sketch has to be run by them?
Yeah, the people from the standards department come to our read-throughs and give us notes on every sketch, and the notes are actually hilarious. I wish I had one of them, because we get a memo on Thursday, and it's always, you know, like, please delete, you know, stick my wiener in your ear. And they're just these, like, very serious legal memos with these stupid phrases on them. It's a matter of, sometimes it's negotiation. A lot of times you hear the word that it's a tonnage issue.
What does that mean?
Yeah, like you can say, you know, boobs in the show, but you can't say it 50 times in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of, and it's really funny in that sometimes in the bargaining back and forth, a lot of times the standards department will offer you a substitution that is so much worse. Because there's so much gray area, and that's the ridiculous thing about the issue is, you know, I've had the standards lady say, well, you can't say pubic hair in this sketch. Could you please change it to coochie hair? And she's like, okay, great, thanks. We've really compromised. The only thing I get sort of uptight about with the FCC stuff is when it moves away from censoring words into censoring ideas or other language that's in no way offensive. Like, we had a sort of a political correctness battle that was kind of funny over a Weekend Update joke that was, the actual news story was something from Puerto Rico. And it was like, this week in Puerto Rico, a Puerto Rican man robbed a bank and blah, blah, blah. And then some punchline. And the standards lady tried to say, oh, please, you can't say that he's Puerto Rican. You can't say that he's... And it was like, this is a story from Puerto Rico. This is not characterizing an American... This is not, you know, a made-up character even of a American made-up criminal that we're characterizing as Latino. Like, this is just the news. That occasionally happens and is a little bit dicey. I think the thing with the networks, too, is their standards things are... Well, now they're probably afraid of the FCC, but mostly they're more afraid of losing sponsors than of government intervention, I think.
Tina Fey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Tina Fey is the co-head writer for Saturday Night Live and co-anchor of its Weekend Update. She wrote and co-stars in the new movie Mean Girls. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with writer Hubert Selby Jr., author of the novel Last Exit to Brooklyn. He died Monday. This is Fresh Air. We're going to listen back to an interview with the writer Hubert Selby Jr. He died Monday at the age of 75. Selby is best known for his 1964 novel Last Exit to Brooklyn, about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. The characters in the novel were brutal, their stories hopeless. Selby said he was trying to portray the horrors of a loveless world. Although the novel is now considered an urban classic, it was shocking and controversial when it was published. It was the subject of a major obscenity trial in England and was banned in Italy. In America, an editor was arrested for having published one of Selby's stories. When Elliot Fremont Smith reviewed the novel in the New York Times, he wrote, quote, "This is a brutal book, shocking, exhausting, depressing. The profound depression it causes, once one starts seriously to read it, is a measure of an authentic power which carries through and beyond revulsion," unquote. Last Exit to Brooklyn is set in the slums around Brooklyn's waterfront, where Selby hung out in 1949. In 1990, I asked Selby to describe the area.
Well, it was at the time as the New York port of embarkation. They used to call it the Brooklyn Army Base. But oh, that operated all through the Second War and the Korean War. And tons of troops and material and equipment was shipped from the Army Base overseas to Europe. And, of course, there was a lot of Navy personnel there as well. And it was like any neighborhood waterfront area. There was a lot of violence, just an incredible amount of violence.
I think one of the best-known characters from your novel is Georgette, who you describe as a hip queer. He's a homosexual, but often dresses in drag and is described as a she in the book. Who is the character based on?
Well, there was a young guy named Georgie that lived in the neighborhood, and I didn't understand my relationship to Georgie at the time, but I realized subsequently that I had a very deep and profound affection and compassion for Georgie, and in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing the book. I wrote the first part of a section of Last Exit called The Queen is Dead. I wrote the first part of that story, and I called it Love's Labor's Lost, and that was published in the Black Mountain Review. And a year or two later, I met someone from the neighborhood, and they said Georgie had been found dead in the streets, literally in the gutter. And evidently died of an OD. And as I said, I didn't understand the emotions behind this at the time, but I knew I had to finish the story. I could not allow Georgie to have died, especially such a humiliating death, without doing something for him. I had to give him I had to dignify his life in some way. And I mean dignify, not romanticize. And so I finished his story, and as I was doing that, the concept for the book developed. So in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing Last Exit to Brooklyn.
I want to ask you, your nickname is Cubby.
Correct.
How did you get the name?
Well, I'm not sure, but when you have a name like Hubert, and you're playing on the streets of Brooklyn with Vinny and Mikey and Tony, and they look at it and say, you bit. You have to do something to survive. And maybe the only reason I survived my childhood was eventually I got to be called Cubby instead of Hubert.
So you dropped out of school when you were 15 and you went to work on the waterfront. Why did you drop out?
I was as restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. And I also knew I could never succeed in school. It terrified me. I couldn't do it. I had to go.
Well, when you were 18, you signed on to a freighter, and that's when you got tuberculosis, right?
Well, actually, I had been sailing on freighters for a couple of years at that point.
I see.
I started, I guess I was 15 or 16 the first time I sailed to Europe, and it was just after my 18th birthday when I was taken off the ship in Germany.
With tuberculosis?
Correct.
Now, if I have this straight, the therapy that they used for you, because you were very sick, was the doctors deflated one lung, took out part of your other lung, and then removed 10 ribs. Why did they remove 10 ribs?
Well, they cut 8 ribs out on one side to collapse that lung permanently. And they cut a couple of ribs out on the other side to cut the piece out of the lung. And they had used an experimental drug to keep me alive. And that impaired my vision and my hearing, and my inner ear was almost totally destroyed, and I couldn't walk. I'd fall down, and all my muscles were petrified from the drug, so it was kind of a mess.
You got hooked on morphine from the hospitalization experience after the TB and the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any medical precautions that were taken, so that you wouldn't get hooked?
Well, you can't prevent it, but, I didn't leave the hospital physically addicted. I just fell in love with the stuff when I got it in the hospital and eventually found it on the streets.
How did you kick?
Oh, it was really very simple. I got arrested and they strapped me down in solitary and I quit my habit.
So you kicked in prison?
Not prison, just a jail, county jail.
Still must have been pretty excruciating.
Well, it was very unpleasant.
Was anybody kind to you while you were there?
Yeah, nobody was unkind. Yeah, the system, of course, is a drag, but there was no... Nobody was nasty to me or anything. And again, you know, I just kind of have a way of finding the biggest, strongest murderer and becoming friends with him, and nobody bothers me.
Really? Is that the trick?
Absolutely.
How did you start to write? You dropped out of high school.
Well, I don't know if I went to high school.
Oh, really?
Well, I did finish the ninth grade. I guess that's high school.
My neighborhood, it was junior high.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, I left at 15. I started to write because I was taken off a ship in Germany when I was 18. They said I couldn't live more than 2 months. And I've been given up for dead many times. And I just didn't want to waste my life. I had what I now realize was a spiritual experience. And what happened was I knew that someday I would die. And just before I died, two things would happen. Number one, I would regret my entire life. And number two, I would want to live my life over again, and then I would die. And that terrified me. As I say, it was a spiritual experience, and you know, as you know, those experiences are far more profound than any experience we can have at this level of consciousness. And to think that I would live my entire life, look at it, and say, oh, I blew it, was such a terrifying thought that I bought a typewriter. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I bought a typewriter because I had no ideas or anything else. But that is what got me to start writing, was I did not want to waste my life. I wanted to, and I had to do something with my life.
Well, writers like Richard Price have credited you with giving them the sense that the stories in their neighborhood, that the language that they and their friends used could be the language of literature. What gave you the idea that your stories and the kind of street language that you used or that people around you used could be the stuff of literature?
Well, when I started to write, I knew I had to write about something I knew, that I couldn't just invent a whole new thing like science fiction or whatever. I knew that that wasn't my area, my shtick. And I was just guided and directed from, again, this inner source, this, you know, this creator of life, whatever it is that exists within all of us. And I certainly didn't define it as such at the time, but everything else was put out of my mind, and my mind only focused on certain things. And so every night for the next 6 years, I came home from work, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. Some nights I'd get one word, some nights two words. But every night for 6 years, I worked on this book, and that was the only thing that was given to me to write, was those experiences.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Hubert Selby Jr. recorded in 1990. He died Monday at the age of 75. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The War on Choice, The Right-Wing Attack on Women's Rights and How to Fight Back by Gloria Felt, president of Planned Parenthood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The next edition of the PBS series Frontline is called The Jesus Factor, and it examines how President Bush's faith has affected his political career. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rainey Aronson, the program's producer and writer, and Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. He's covered George W. Bush through his political career. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.